If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. And I am excited to say one of the best dancing partners I have, Dr. Ernie Ward, is here. He is founder and president of the Association of Pet Obesity Prevention. Dr. Ward, good morning.
Oh, Steve, thank you so much for having me. And I got to say, you are the one with the fancy dancing shoes, my friend. I've got Irish hips. They only go up and down.
Well, let's see how it goes. And I bet it goes very well. So we begin here. Explain what the Association of Pet Obesity Prevention is.
Yeah, Steve, great starting question. And, you know, back in 2005, I was sort of faced with a clinical dilemma. You know, I was doing a lot of writing and lecturing, as you know, back then, and really focused on senior pets and a lot of laboratory tests. I was working on, you know, different ways to interpret, you know, lab tests for chronic diseases in particular. And I started seeing more and more cats and dogs with obesity. And, you know, you look at the literature, I'm hanging out with all the experts, and really people are dismissing it, Steve, as you know, kind of as a joke, as funny. You know, Garfield, the fat, happy, lasagna-eating cat. And, you know, well, look, a dog's supposed to be fat and lazy. And all these kind of things, we were dismissing what I considered a serious medical condition. And so really upon the spurring of a good friend of mine, the past president of the American College of Veterinary Surgeons, Steve Budsberg, he said, well, Ernie, you know, if you're so fired up about this, why don't you do something about it? And I said, Steve, I will if you help me. And so we put together a board, and really that's how we started the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention. And you'll notice that the terminology, Steve, that we used there was really aimed, you know, because this is 21 years ago, at preventing the disease of obesity. And, you know, and that still is our ultimate gain. We would love to prevent any disease, whether it's cancer or arthritis or chronic kidney disease, as your, you know, heart disease in cats. We'd love to be able to prevent them. But we've also now recognized over the past decade that interventions, medical interventions, are really also going to be an important part of the story moving forward. And obviously, your listeners are familiar with all the GLP drugs that are out there. They're seeing it in the news daily. And those drugs are currently being trialed for cats, for sure, and some people are working on it for dogs. So, Steve, I think that our mindset is going to move from just preventing the disease, which is always the ultimate goal, but also into intervention and treating.
Wow, you're way ahead of me. All right, so let's get back to this. Association of Pet Obesity Prevention to identify a disease. Is obesity a disease?
Yeah, it is. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that is one of the things, the legacies that we're still kind of confronting, is the fact that for a long time in both human and veterinary medicine, you know, obesity was considered a lifestyle decision, right? You chose to eat too much or not exercise your dog or cat or feed them too many treats. We really felt like it was a matter of choice, of discipline, of commitment, you know, willpower, all those kinds of things. And I think what's been so refreshing to me is as the science has progressed, the understanding of the biology of obesity has also evolved. And so now we firmly understand that obesity is multifactorial. You've got a lot of different factors playing into obesity. You've got genetics. You've got your own individual physiology and metabolism. You've got the microbiome's tremendous influence on our overall health. I mean, you've got drugs that you may be giving your dog or cat. I mean, Steve, there's a long list of issues, hormonal imbalances. I mean, we could go on and on. The role of microplastics and BPA in the environment. You know, I mean, there's a lot of contributors to obesity. And so I think, like you're getting at here, we've really got to shift our mindset, and we are, into understanding this is a true disease state, just like cancer, just like osteoarthritis, just like heart disease or kidney disease. And we've got to treat it more seriously.
What's the latest as far as numbers, the percent of cats and dogs that are overweight or obese?
Yeah, when we look back at the 2024, we do these surveys every couple of years in the United States and North America. We're still right around 60% of dogs and cats. Technically, it's like 59% of dogs and 61% of cats. But, you know, Steve, as you know, it's probably higher than that. These are actually dogs and cats evaluated by a veterinary professional, you know, so, you know, we do this to try to get a close approximation. But, you know, it's about 60%. Now, what's interesting, Steve, is last year, so every other year we do the big prevalence surveys, as you know, and again, I appreciate all of your support as a board member of APOP. But every other year, we also do a survey of pet owners and veterinary professionals, and we ask them to give us their assessment, no vet involved, no veterinary technician. We just say, tell us how you think your pet's body condition is. And Steve, every year, the numbers are about the same. About half of all of the pet owners, a little more than half of dogs and cats, say, my cat or dog is at a healthy, normal body condition or weight. And that just doesn't match up. And again, what it shows us is that there's still a big gap between the understanding of what a normal, healthy body condition is, you know, not excess body fat that contributes to this disease, and what's the reality. So, you know, again, there's still a lot of work to be done and just the recognition and awareness, but, you know, we're making strides. We're slowly getting there.
All right. So I want to make a point of something and back up a couple steps here. I want to make it absolutely abundantly clear that if you feed your dog or cat too much table food, yeah, it's impactful. I don't believe you'd say it isn't, but that for...
No.
Each individual pet is different first. And secondly, it probably isn't the sole reason, if it is even a reason, as to why your pet is overweight or obese.
Right. And, you know, Stephen, that's a really good point. I appreciate you repeating that. You know, for the listeners today, you know, I focus on the clinical impacts, the disease state. And we actually have defined that now as what we call clinical obesity, right? And that's to distinguish the, you know, adjective, the descriptor of overweight or obese. Right. So we're trying to now what I'm talking about today is actually an active disease state. And we really use a simple heuristic, you know, and you guys can remember this easily, to diagnose clinical obesity. Of course, there's a lot of we have a rubric and all these different things we look at, but it's simple. We call it the three A's. So basically, if your pet meets these three A's, then we would start to talk about clinical obesity. And the three A's are as follows. Excess adiposity. Okay, so first of all, that's an excess in body fat. So the first A, excess adiposity, right? The second is an objective abnormality. So that abnormality can be something like limping. The cat has difficulty breathing. You know, they have some other objective findings. Could be a blood test abnormality, right? And then the third A is a plausible attribution. Right. So we have to be able to take that excess body fat and that objective abnormality and say it's plausibly attributed or caused by the body fat, the obesity. And if you meet those three A's, then you've got clinical obesity. Now, that's a mouthful for you guys out there. But I want people to understand that when we are now talking about potentially using future drugs, we're talking about medical interventions, doing laboratory tests. Then we're looking for something called clinical obesity, which, again, is very serious. That's to be distinguished from your dog or cat needs to lose a couple of pounds. They now have an active disease state that's, quite frankly, not only robbing their quality of life, Steve, but robbing years off of their life.
Which I want to talk about. You are going exactly where I want to go. You see, the best dance partner there is. Dr. Ernie Ward, when we come back on WGN. From the Association of Pet Obesity Prevention, it is Dr. Ernie Ward, and we're talking about, okay, how many animals are actually overweight or obese, and also dispelling the myth that is still out there, for sure, that is just a matter of treats. And I know I've brought this up twice now, but I want you to talk about it just one more time. That's extra calories, depending on the treats we're giving, including table snacks from our table. Explain that impact and that the impact is there, but there's more to it than that.
Yeah, and Steve, you nailed it, right? I mean, obviously, if you overfeed and underexercise your dog or cat, they're going to gain excess body fat. The issue is then, A, can you just cut back those calories, increase the activity, and they shed that healthy, that unhealthy fat and reach a healthy body condition, or do they struggle with it? And we know from our surveys year after year, and these results held up just last year, that over half of dog and cat owners reported to us in our national survey that they had tried to help their dog or cat lose weight. Over half, 56% of dog owners, 53% of cat owners. But here's the rub. Only 28% of dog owners said, yep, we were able to get the weight off, and only 19% of cats. So, Steve, we know that it's not as simple as just feed them less, exercise more. The other part of this equation, though, is, again, there's usually this confounding factor. And before the break, we talked about the three A's. You got excess adiposity or body fat. You've got an objective abnormality, some kind of, you know, impairment to life, you know, a blood test, inability to walk normally, whatever. And then we have a plausible attribution. Those three A's equal that disease. Well, the thing is, when a vet prescribes a, you know, reduce the feeding, exercise more, we know that that just doesn't work for all of these conditions. I think that's been the biggest sort of reveal of the GLPs, because millions of people around the world, Steve, have struggled to get to a healthy body condition, right? And they couldn't. They tried every diet under the sun. They went to every They went to every gym. They had personal trainers. They did nutritionists and all that stuff. And they could never get to that healthy body condition. And so suddenly now, when we intervene biologically, we see different results. So that's really where, you know, I'm trying to get at. Now, I will say, if you're listening today, being precise with your feeding is without a doubt the most important thing you can do as a good pet parent, right? So you do need to be measuring your food. Ideally, you would be weighing those foods. But the reality is most folks, Steve, still just sort of eyeball it. They feed their cat an all-day buffet. You know, they just don't ever pay attention to the calories. And, of course, that is going to lead to a problem.
All right. And I will talk, I promise, about how to solve that problem and GLP-1s for pets? We'll get to that. All right. So I will go so far to say, and you, sir, may or may not agree, that diabetes in cats is at epidemic proportions. And what we know, that of course you agree with because it's true, that there is a link between being a cat being overweight or obese and being diabetic. In fact, if the cat isn't obese or sometimes just overweight, diabetes in cats is not going to happen. So can you talk about the impact, because diabetes can't be a good thing. Can you talk about the impact diabetes, and way beyond that, there are so many other medical issues in cats and dogs, Dr. Ward?
Yeah, Steve, great point. And so for listeners today, if you have a cat, there is a causal relationship between excess adiposity, clinical obesity, and diabetes. And of course, you know this from human studies, and cats and humans are more similar in the way they sort of express diabetes. Dogs have a slightly different take on it, and that's just because biologically they're different. But the reality is, Steve, you're right. Unless you have obesity in a feline, in the feline species, you're not going to have obesity except for in some very rare exceptions of specific pancreatic diseases. So you're right. Yep. You have a cat that has obesity. The next thing is going to be diabetes, and it's almost that direct, right? It's kind of almost not a if, it's just when. Mm-hmm. So if you right now, if you got a cat and it's 14, 15, 16 or more pounds, the last time you were at the vet and the vet said, hey, you know, you really do need to help this cat slim down a little bit, take it seriously. Because, Steve, the next step on that physiological train is going to be diabetes. And once that happens, you may get some temporary reprieve. You may lose some of that excess body fat in that kitty cat, and it sort of has a temporary cessation of diabetes, but it's coming back. And so that's where it breaks my heart, because right now, if I could just do one thing in this world, it would be to remove obesity from cats, because, Steve, the link between diabetes is there. It's clearly established in the research, and it breaks my heart because it is literally shortening these cats' lives tremendously.
Absolutely. Of course, I agree with that, but it goes beyond that. I won't even mention everything, and I'll let you chime in there because you're the expert, but we're talking now dogs and cats. We're talking increase in osteoarthritis. We're talking increase in cancers. We're talking an increase in, well, what am I missing? Lots of other things, too.
Well, yeah, and that list keeps growing, unfortunately. So the big one on that list that we sort of didn't discuss was liver disease.
Right.
And so as we've learned now, you know, cats and dogs have all sorts of problems with liver function if they have excess body fat. And I'll tell you, I have an upcoming textbook on the pathophysiology of obesity coming. Again, this is for veterinary schools and for veterinarians, but we go into great detail. And one of my idols is a guy from Japan, Dr. Kawasumi, and he's been researching this particular element of obesity, liver disease, and diabetes for the last 20 plus years. And he contributed a fantastic, you know, biomarkers chapter to my textbook. But it's been great to sort of get to know him over the last couple of years. And you know, Steve, this story goes much deeper than we even recognize. So again, you talked about liver disease, but we've got high blood pressure in cats, a very big problem. We've got all kinds of problems with kidney disease. There's a direct link between obesity and kidney disease in dogs and cats, quite frankly. And so we're starting now to see, wow, this is much bigger than just, Garfield's a cute fat cat. This is actually a cat that has a very serious disease that has very serious consequences. The great news is, Steve, I mean, we can A, prevent it in almost all cases, and B, treatments are available today that are highly effective, and we've got even better things on the horizon.
All right. Again, you are ahead of me. So the tease that Dr. Ward just did for me, I want to talk about treatments on the horizon, and I want to talk about prevention. He's amazing. Dr. Ernie Ward is in my head. He knows what I want to say. And we will say all those things and talk about all those things when we come back with Dr. Ernie Ward, Association of Pet Obesity Prevention on WGN. The website for the Association of Pet Obesity Prevention is kind of new and updated, and I wanted to have you, Dr. Ward, on the radio, as you know, for some time, and you say, no, I can't. I'm in Singapore. No, I can't. I'm speaking in Brazil. No, I can't. I'm off in Spain speaking. I can't. I'm in Kenya speaking, you know? So we finally caught you, as you are all over the world, talking about this and other issues related to pet obesity. How is this issue a worldwide issue?
Yeah, and that's really been the most terrifying aspect of this, quite frankly. Laura Ward, who of course serves as the executive director, my wife, for the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention, contributed a chapter. She's a science nerd. She's brilliant at statistics, and she compiled all of the known evidence around the world when it comes to pet obesity in dogs and cats. And what the pattern is very clear. It's no surprise to the listeners, but in every developed nation that has conducted any kind of prevalent survey around obesity in dogs and cats, the numbers are going up. And, you know, this is in Japan, this is in Brazil, this is in Italy, you name it, right? I mean, in Argentina, all of South America. And so we're starting now to really see this is a global issue. Now, it is true, it tends to be in developed nations, and this tends to be more with dogs and cats that are now kept in homes or in smaller yards. So there's a lot of environmental pressure, you know, an obesogenic environment, as we like to call it. But again, that doesn't really change the clinical obesity aspect. It just means that we're seeing more of it. So it is a global phenomenon, just like a human obesity epidemic. And so for us, you know, we just want to make sure that as we move forward, and one of the things we're really working hard with, especially in emerging nations like South America right now, like in Brazil, we are really doubling down our efforts of outreach for those veterinary communities, because we know now's the time for them to actually get in front of this message and start to talk about the importance of proper nutrition, proper exercise and care, because that can potentially prevent some of these future problems. But, you know, overall, Steve, just like you said, I mean, this is a global issue and it just seems to be getting worse.
You know, in the last segment, we were talking about how diabetes in cats for sure is directly associated with cats being overweight or obese, and a long list of other significant medical issues. However, what we missed, didn't talk about, and you know I feel very strongly about this, is I feel anyway, and I'll hear how you feel in a moment, that these animals that are obese are often also clinically depressed. I mean, if a cat cannot do what cats were born to do, simply groom themselves, if the dog or cat can't jump on the couch to be with you because they're physically unable to do so because they're so overweight, and the list goes on and on. A dog needs to sniff the world, you know, and if a dog is too overweight to take any walk at all, and there are dogs that are, that dog, I say, is suffering mentally as well as physically. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. You know, Steve, I first flagged this as an emerging issue in one of my first books on obesity going back to 2009 called Chow Hounds. And I devoted a chapter to the behavioral impacts of obesity in dogs. And I was roundly criticized by my colleagues, to be quite frank. You know, a lot of folks at that time had a different mindset and perspective on behavior and sort of could obesity affect it? And I was really getting into the neurochemistry, which is a large body of evidence in the research community on the different neurochemicals that are affected, the primary neurotransmitters that are affected in obesity. And what's been sort of gratifying and validating is the fact that the science now has caught up with some of that. So you're absolutely right. These dogs and cats have altered mentation, altered behavior. The term depression is one that we don't typically apply to our veterinary patients, but I agree. The sentiment is sound. So these dogs and cats are not living to their potential. They're not able to express themselves as a species with their unique, you know, actions on the world and behaviors because the obesity is robbing of that. And I think that, you and I talk about the physical impairments. That's one of those three A's, right? That's the objective abnormality and an impairment, such as not being able to walk or play or jump up on the bed. Those rob that kind of joy and enjoyment of life. But I think also there's a deeper neurochemical that, you know, how the body's physiology has changed. So, and we see a lot of that, you know, it's been really interesting to watch as GLPs have, you know, over the last 20 years been widely used in human populations, Steve. One of the things they found is that it affects, you know, we talk about food drive and food noise and cravings and all that stuff. So we know that these pathways are all interrelated. And I think, again, it would be a bit naive to think that somehow those same pathways aren't preserved in dogs and cats as far as that behavior. And that's one of the things that I'm most excited about as we kind of emerge into this next era of drug treatments potentially for dogs and cats and obesity. Then, you know, we may see all kind of amazing improvements just in like you said, in their mental status.
Now, is there any way, and I want to talk about treatment in our next segment, but in the literally 2.5 minutes we have left here, is there any way to prevent this? It's Pet Obesity Prevention Association of. So right. Is there any way to prevent this from happening, aside from the obvious, not feeding too much table food, too many treats, measuring the food? We've talked about all that. Anything else that people can do?
Yeah, I mean, Steve, that's the thing. It's that simple. It really is a matter of being present, of noticing, of actually being, you know, attentive to how much you're feeding. I mean, that's kind of the groundwork for all of this. Now, obviously, there are biological exceptions. There are predispositions. We talked about genetics and metabolism. We talked about environmental issues and so forth. I mean, so there are things that sort of nudge you in the direction of disease, but you still have so much power over this, you know? And again, if we could just dial back, you know, the VHS tape of life for every dog and cat, where the biggest time to intervene is immediately after spay and neuter. Because in that 6-month period after spay and neuter, and really you could extend that to 9 to 12 months, but really it's that first 6 months, that is where we see this rapid gain in body fat. And a lot of it just has to do with people not adequately adjusting the caloric intake. They feed them too much, Steve. They feed them the wrong things, especially during that after spay and neuter. Now, obviously, we don't want people, you know, to stop feeding or feed less to a growing dog or cat, but we do need to be a little more sophisticated. And that's one of the things, I mean, you know, Steve, science continues to make progress. We now have better therapeutic options, better diet options immediately following post-spay and neuter. I mean, there are companies that have done amazing research. They have developed specific diets for that period. And if we could really just sort of capture that part of life and say, we want to slow down the excess body fat accumulation from that immediate 6 to 12 month period after spay and neuter, Steve, I would almost guarantee we would knock down obesity rates by half.
You know, and you brought up a fascinating topic there. I'm going to ask you about spay-neuter. We want to spay-neuter our pets, but I have a question about that. And yes, we'll talk, I promise, about GLP-1s for pets when we come back with Dr. Ernie Ward on WGN. Dr. Ernie Ward is here. He is the founder and president of the Association of Pet Obesity Prevention, and dare I say, a longtime friend of mine who I've heard speak on topics like what we're talking about. He speaks to veterinarians all over the world. All right, so I wonder about this, and I've never kind of put it together this way before, Dr. Ward, but I wonder if before we commonly spayed, neutered our pets, there was as much as far as overweight and obese pets. Now, we didn't have as many treats then, and we didn't necessarily treat pets as family quite the same way as we do today, so maybe not offering as much table food. But I wonder also what the role is there, because we do know there is a physiological factor.
Yeah, you couldn't be more right. And in fact, this is such a serious issue that needs so much more education of the veterinary community. I've got two chapters devoted in my upcoming textbook on clinical obesity devoted to the topic. The first topic is written by a guy named Dr. Kurt Kramer from South Africa. Many folks in the theriogenology or the study of reproduction in dogs and cats are familiar with Dr. Kramer. But, you know, he wrote a brilliant chapter just talking about the deep physiological metabolic changes that occur after spaying and neutering in dogs and cats. And it's profound, Steve. It's very significant. It changes everything from how we metabolize and catabolize proteins to fats to carbohydrates to where fat is stored. I mean, the whole shooting match, so to speak, is right there in that chapter. And then the second one was by Dr. Laura Gaylord, a veterinary nutritionist, who actually wrote a chapter saying, I said, look, I need a chapter devoted to that period of time that I was discussing. Immediately after spay and neuter, that first 6 to 12 months, that's the critical era. Can you do a deep dive into the research? And it's a phenomenal chapter. I'm super, super excited for veterinary students and veterinarians to learn about that. So for me, it's everything changes physiologically, the biology changes, and we have got to adapt. Now, if you're listening today, you know, this isn't the time that we would ever give GLPs, right? This is the time that we actually get more sophisticated and smart about what we feed. We change the formulation, we change the mixtures to fats and proteins and so forth. And, you know, a lot of folks are like, oh, you know, if you just feed them the right amount, it's just not that simple, Steve, because as you know, during that period of time, especially the first, you know, 18 months or so of life, we got to grow bones, we got to grow muscles and tendons, we got to grow nerves and brain cells. So you can't just feed them less, and you've got to be very precise with the nutrient matrix there, the mixture and formulation. So that's been the exciting thing. But you're absolutely right, when we look at other countries, they don't see the obesity as early as we do, okay? And that's been one of those things that sort of flies under the radar, but they do. So France and Germany and the UK, they do have, you know, similar obesity rates as far as we can tell. But what happens is it's typically shifted later in life, which, if you're curious, actually has less long-term physiological impact. The problem with obesity, Steve, is the longer that excess body fat is pumping out all of those extra hormones and compounds and chemicals, the more damage it does, right? So this is a compound interest issue. The longer that body fat is there. And so for American dogs, which are typically, and cats, which are spayed at an earlier age, that just means they've got more risk over their lifetime.
All right. GLP-1s for pets, they're coming, huh?
Yeah. I mean, there are at least two FDA trials as we are recording this that are going on. I can tell you there are several other of the major pharmaceutical countries around the world that have identified target molecules that they are interested in. I mean, and it's not a new story. I mean, you know, if you go back 20 years ago when the first GLPs were patented and FDA approved in this country, almost all of them did some type of safety studies in dogs or cats. Most of them use some dogs and other, of course, lab animals and so forth. So, Steve, you know, it's not that we didn't know these drugs would work. And in fact, you know, we've already had one drug in the United States approved, you know, about 20 years ago. Slightly different, not an incretin or a GLP type of drug, but, you know, and it didn't work for a lot of reasons. It actually worked. It was great at losing weight. It just kind of didn't fit the market at the time for a lot of side effect issues.
Yeah.
But Steve, you know, as we move forward, you're going to find better, safer, more efficacious drugs. And so people always ask me, is it going to happen? Most likely, yes. But it will be really dependent on the delivery, right? So, like, is this going to be an injection that you give once a week, or every one of them is actually given every 6 months? Is it going to be a pill? I mean, all of those things are yet to be determined, and that will really, you know, determine whether or not they succeed. And so for me, Steve, the question is not, Do they work? They do. The question is, how do we get them into the dog or cat that will measure whether or not, you know, it succeeds?
Oh, what I'm concerned about is also price, because if they're priced out out of the pocket of many people, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah, right. And see, that's a fair point, and one that none of us has any control or insight into. These are big drug company discussions. Although I will say this, currently the two drugs that are being trialed by, you know, in FDA approved trials, they're both generic versions of the first generation of GLP-1. So cost wouldn't necessarily be the biggest issue there, you know, just based on the current market prices for those drugs. But it is absolutely, you know, like you said, delivery and cost will determine whether or not this is widely accepted.
However, a therapeutic or prescription dog or cat foods can make a difference as well. But again, absolutely, increasingly, with the economy being what it is, cost is a factor there too.
Yeah, and that's a really good point to make, because, you know, it's the overall petflation is still something that concerns a lot of folks like me and you, because we know that then is another barrier to the access of veterinary care. And so there are some phenomenal, I mean, right now, you know, look, we have tremendous success at helping dogs and cats achieve a healthy body condition and, of course, you know, preserve quality of life and avoid disease using some of these very sophisticated therapeutic diets. But, you know, at the end of the day, if you can't afford it, it's not going to help you.
So the good news is there's a diet, at least one, for post, right after spay-neuter, that's available. Your veterinarian will know about that diet, I think, as well as other therapeutic diets that help maintain a fair weight or help the pet to lower weight. We literally have a 1 minute left. For the first time, I think veterinarians are looking harder at body condition scoring as well.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up. This is not about chasing a number on a scale. This is about achieving a healthy body condition, the composition, the lean muscle mass to fat. That's really the whole issue here. And that's been the one thing that I think we've worked tirelessly for at the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention, is to sort of bring this awareness that, guys, we're not just focusing on how much your dog or cat weighs. We want to look at it, evaluate what the body fat composition looks like. And right now, of course, we can do that really through a series of palpations and feeling your dog and cat, and we can get a pretty close approximation. But Steve, you're absolutely right. This has nothing to do with weight. This has everything to do with excess body fat, which gets us back to those three A's: excess body fat, adiposity, an objective abnormality with a plausible attribution. Those are the three things that make it so dangerous for our dogs and cats. So body condition is just right there. That's the foundation.
Well, as I said at the start, one of the best dancing partners I have. Great to dance with you, as always, Dr. Ernie Ward, founder and president, Association of Pet Obesity Prevention. What is the website, new and improved?
PetObesityPrevention.org. We've got tremendous amount of pet owner resources. If you're a veterinary professional listening, we've got all the calculators out. We've got updated muscle condition charts. I mean, check it out. And of course, we have newsletters that go out, you know, on a monthly basis and for pet owners about once a quarter. But definitely check us out, petobesityprevention.org. Again, we are a nonprofit dedicated to helping prevent the disease of obesity in animals.
PetAssociationPrevention.org. Dr. Ward, thank you so much. I was wrong, and I'll be the first to explain what happened. Well, first of all, a couple of weeks ago, I was celebrating, as they deserve to be, military working dogs around Memorial Day, talking about how these dogs have, over the years, going back to World War I, saved countless lives. We have no idea how many. It's been estimated, though, well into the hundreds of thousands of military lives and other lives as well. Even lives of civilians. These dogs are true heroes. They have been heroes. They continue to be. And then I said, well, there are no military working cats. That's where I was wrong. There kind of are. True enough, so far, anyway, no bomb-sniffing cats. Cats guarding military bases hasn't occurred, or cats directing platoons or to circumvent an IED or landmines. So what do cats do? Well, even prior to military working dogs and World War I, cats have been, quote-unquote, employed on naval vessels. What do they do on naval vessels? Well, they take care of the rodents, primarily rats. And why is that important? Rats love to chew on wires of all sorts of things. So some of the weaponry we have that over the years and continues to this day to use wires, we don't want rats chewing on those. Never mind the actual wires in the ship itself or other things on the ship. What's more, rats can transmit disease. Now, this is true not only on ships, but military bases, not only in the United States, but around the world. And in the U.S., oftentimes trap, neuter, vaccinate, return the cats. And if they're friendly cats, there's one more benefit, and that is just having cats around. But let me get back to the disease spreading part of it. Now, the hantavirus, which we heard about recently, which happened on a cruise ship, the MV Hondius, I believe it's pronounced. Yeah, that's an Andean strain of this rare disease. It's possible, but that is extremely unlikely. What is more likely is leptospirosis. By the way, dogs that are not vaccinated for lepto can get leptospirosis from many animals, but rats are at the top of the list. And also people can get leptospirosis. But what's more than that, rats sometimes spread other diseases as well. Now, it's great that military working dogs receive medals and the headlines. They should. But cats living around American military installations or on naval vessels deserve their day, too. Let's have a cat statue for military working cats. Shepherd Dieter Meckler had no real answer as to why 50 members of his flock of sheep split off from the 500 members in the herd, and they made their way into a penny supermarket in Germany. The sheep wandered up and down the aisle. Sadly for the store, in their wake, they left dozens of broken bottles, not to mention piles of you know what, and a few individual thieves made off with no, not lamb chops, please. They made off with chips. Who knew sheep liked chips? It's unclear why the rogue sheep broke off from the herd in the first place or how they entered the store altogether. Customers, they were pushed out of the way and literally made their way to higher ground, as did employees, jumping onto checkout counters to get away from it all and watch the bedlam ensue. All of this, in the end, was a very bad day for store management. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.